When you learned to ride a bike, you didn't carry a little notebook in your pocket that you flipped open mid-ride, checking your notes on balance and pedaling while you wobbled down the sidewalk. That would be absurd. You learned it into your body. The knowledge changed the same machinery that does the riding. Now here's the strange thing. Almost every AI agent built today with a memory is the rider with the notebook. It can write things down, file them away, look them back up, but the part of it that actually thinks never changes. The notebook gets thicker. The rider stays exactly the same.
And that gap between writing something down and actually internalizing it is the whole reason this paper exists.
It is. And that distinction is the spine of the paper we're digging into. It went up on Archive on June 3rd, 2026, and we're recording the very next day. Quick note before we get into it. This episode is AI-generated. The script came from Anthropic's Claude Opus 4.8. I'm Cassidy, and the other voice you'll hear is Tyler. And we're both AI voices from 11 Labs. The show is produced independently, with no affiliation to either company. The paper is called Scaling Self-Evolving Agents Via Parametric Memory, out of Peking University and Alibaba. And what it's really chasing is exactly that gap. Between an agent that can look something up and an agent that can learn from what it's seen.
The authors actually open with a line from the neuroscientist Eric Kandel. We are who we are because of what we learn and what we remember. And the point they're making with it is biological. In a real brain, learning and memory aren't two separate systems. Experience physically rewires the same neurons that do the computing. There's no notebook. The substrate that thinks is the substrate that changes.
Right, and current language model agents break that coupling completely. So let me lay out where an agent's memory actually lives today, because the paper splits it into channels, and keeping them straight matters for everything that follows. Picture three places an agent can keep what it knows. The first is the working context. That's the sticky notes scattered on your desk right now. Immediate, useful, but limited space. And you're constantly clearing it. For a language model, that's the context window. The recent conversation, the tool outputs, whatever's loaded in at this moment. The second channel is a filing cabinet. When the desk gets too full, you summarize the notes. Or you stash documents in a drawer you can go search later. That's what today's memory agents do. Compress the past into summaries, or drop it into a retrieval index and pull bits back when a query seems relevant.
And the crucial thing about both of those is that the model's actual weights, the giant pile of numbers that defines how it thinks, never move, frozen the entire time. The desk and the filing cabinet are both just arranging information around a brain that stays fixed.
Which is where the third channel comes in, and it's the new one. The third channel is changing your habits. Not writing a note about how to do something, but internalizing it so deeply that it just shapes how you act, automatically, no lookup required. The paper's version of that is a small, writable set of weights that the agent can edit mid-conversation. They call these fast weights.
And I want to be precise about why this isn't just a fancier filing cabinet, because that's the easy misread. The two prompt space approaches, summaries and retrieval, share a structural ceiling. A summary is a lossy bottleneck. It throws away fine-grained detail by definition. Retrieval is only as good as your embeddings and your query phrasing, and building a clean memory store is genuinely fiddly. But the deeper problem is the one Cassidy just named. Both of them leave the decision-making machinery untouched. Anything that falls out of the context window when you summarize or truncate, it's just gone. It has no remaining pathway to influence what the agent does next.
So here's the one-sentence version of what the paper proposes. The agent pauses mid-episode, distills what it's learned so far into question and answer flashcards, and trains those flashcards directly into that small writable set of its own weights. So its behavior genuinely changes for the rest of the episode. And then, the clever part, they use reinforcement learning to make the agent good at writing flashcards it can actually learn from.
Okay, trains the flashcards into its weights mid-episode. Walk me through what that actually looks like as a loop, because that's the move that sounds almost too aggressive to work.
It's a clean cycle, and it's worth picturing step by step. The agent's running along, doing normal work, calling tools, reading observations, answering, piling up tokens in its working context. The desk is filling up. The moment the combined length of everything it's holding crosses a preset budget, they call it the trigger. Instead of just summarizing and moving on, the agent flips into a memory writing mode. In that mode, it gets handed a prompt that essentially says, "Produce high-quality question and answer pairs grounded only in this session." It generates them as a structured list. Then a quick, lightweight training step bakes those QA pairs into the fast weights. Just a handful of gradient updates on that tiny adapter. And then it clears the context. The desk gets wiped clean. But the knowledge isn't lost because it didn't stay on the desk. It moved into the weights. It's now part of how the model computes.
And these updates stack, right? It's not resetting each time.
Exactly. They're cumulative across the episode. Each new trigger starts from the current state of the adapter, not from scratch. So over a long session, the fast weights keep accreting the distilled experience. By the end, the agent is, in a literal sense, a slightly different model than the one that started.
There's an elegant formal consequence here that I think is underappreciated. If you take their framework and just set that writable weight channel to zero, never touch the weights, you recover ordinary prompt space memory agents exactly. The whole existing field becomes a special case. TMEM is just what happens when you let that parametric channel be non-zero and, more importantly, trainable.
Which is a nice way to position it. It's not throwing out the filing cabinet. It's saying the filing cabinet was always the version where the third channel happened to be switched off.
Now, the technical hinge everyone should understand. This writable weight set is a LoRa adapter. And for anyone who hasn't bumped into LoRa, the picture is just this. You've got a big frozen brain, and you bolt a tiny add-on set of weights onto it. You only ever train the little add-on. The big model never moves. That's what makes editing mid-conversation even thinkable. You obviously can't retrain a 4 billion parameter model every few thousand tokens. But a tiny adapter? You can nudge that in a few steps.
And theirs is genuinely tiny. We're talking about a LoRa rank of 6, attached only to the feed-forward projections in the last 4 layers of the network. Attention is left completely alone. It's a very small scratch pad of weights riding on top of a frozen brain.
Which raises an obvious problem, and this is the part I find genuinely clever. If your scratch pad is tiny and you only get a handful of gradient steps per memory write, then where you start those steps matters enormously. You can't afford to waste them.
This is the singular value decomposition piece. Tyler, this is the bit you wanted to spend time on. Take it.
Yeah, because I think it's the most intellectually satisfying idea in the paper, and it's easy to skip past. So, the standard way you'd initialize one of these LoRa adapters is randomly. You drop it in some arbitrary direction and let training figure out where to go. In the normal regime, thousands of training steps, that's totally fine. Random is fine because you have time to wander. But here you don't have time. You get maybe a handful of steps. So picture being dropped into a strange city and told you have 5 minutes to find something useful. If you land at a random street corner, most of your 5 minutes goes to just figuring out where anything is. You barely make progress before time's up. What they do instead is use singular value decomposition, and you don't need the linear algebra, you just need this picture. A trained model's weights have a few directions where most of the action lives. The dominant patterns the model has actually learned. SVD is the tool that finds those high-energy directions and ranks them. So instead of dropping the adapter at a random corner, they drop it right in the neighborhood the model already knows is important. Your 5 minutes now go toward actual progress instead of orientation.
And do they actually prove that's better, or is it just a good hunch that happens to work?
They prove a version of it. There's a theorem showing this initialization gives you an approximation that's never worse than random,
and strictly better whenever the thing you're trying to learn has more than its fair share of its energy concentrated in those top directions. Which, they argue, is basically always the case, because pre-trained models have spectra that decay fast, and fine-tuning updates tend to pile into the leading directions anyway. But honestly, the part I find more compelling is a second effect they flag almost in passing. This initialization acts like a built-in preconditioner. The update along each of those important directions automatically gets scaled by how important the direction is. So the directions that matter most get proportionally bigger steps for free. Random initialization treats every direction the same and gets no such head start. To extend the city analogy, it's not just that you start in the right neighborhood. It's that you've got a car for the long avenues and you're on foot for the short side streets. The effort gets allocated to where it pays off. And in a few-step regime, that's the difference between converging and not.
That's a great frame, Tyler. And it reframes the whole thing for me. Because the initialization stops being a tuning detail and becomes the thing that makes few-step online adaptation actually possible at all. Without it, you just spin.
That's exactly the author's claim. And they're honest that it's load-bearing rather than cosmetic.
Okay, so we've got the third channel, and we've got a smart way to seed the adapter. But there's a piece we've been dancing around, which is, how does the agent know what makes a good flashcard? Because the whole thing lives or dies on that. If it writes garbage QA pairs and trains on them, it's poisoning its own weights. And this is where the single most persuasive result in the paper shows up. And I think it's the moment the core idea actually clicks. They ran an experiment asking, what form should the thing you write into memory take? They tried three options for what to feed that online training step. Option one, raw next token prediction. Just train on the context verbatim. Feed the model the transcript and have it learn to predict it. Option two, free-form summaries. The classic approach, skim and jot the gist. Option three, their question and answer flashcards.
And the spread is dramatic, right? This isn't a marginal effect.
It's enormous. On their long conversation benchmark, training on raw context scores about 10 on their F1 metric. 10. It's catastrophic. Because what you're doing is teaching the model to parrot the transcript back, not to know anything. Summaries jump you all the way up to around 35, and the flashcards hit 41. The jump from summaries to flashcards alone is nearly 6 points. And here's why I think that's the real payoff of the whole paper. Anyone who's ever crammed for an exam knows this in their bones. Recopying the textbook word for word teaches you almost nothing. Skimming and writing the gist is better. But quizzing yourself, forcing the material into question and answer form, is what actually makes it stick. The flashcard format forces the knowledge into a usable, retrievable shape. And the experiment is saying cleanly, it's not that you write something into memory that matters. It's the structure of what you write.
And that's a deeper claim than the headline accuracy numbers, because it's mechanistic. It's telling you why the thing works, not just that it works. The distillation structure is doing the heavy lifting.
So now the question becomes, how do you get the model to write good flashcards reliably? And this is the third pillar, the reinforcement learning loop. Tyler, this is yours.
It is. So, the setup. The act of writing memory produces the training data for the agent's own future self. That means the quality of those flashcards directly determines how good the agent gets. So you'd love to train the model to be good at writing them. The question is, how? And there's an obvious, brutal way to do it. You could try to trace the entire chain backwards. The final reward depends on a late answer, which depends on the adapted weights, which depend on the training step, which depends on the flashcards the model wrote. So differentiate through all of it. The problem is that differentiate through a training step means differentiating through an optimizer, through the act of learning itself. That's expensive and notoriously unstable. People avoid it for good reason.
So what's the shortcut?
The shortcut is what's called a stop gradient, and the analogy I'd reach for is grading a study guide by the exam score. Think about a student who writes themselves a study guide, studies from it, then takes a test. You want to teach them to write better study guides. The hard way is to model exactly how each note rewired their brain and changed each answer. The easy way. You don't model any of that. You just notice the student did well on the exam, and you reinforce whatever they wrote. You treat the study guide as a normal thing the student produced, and you reward it based on the outcome. That's the trick. The flashcards the model writes are, at the end of the day, just generated text. A sequence of tokens with a computable probability, like any other action the agent takes. So you can reward or penalize that action directly with standard policy gradient reinforcement learning. You explicitly cut the gradient at the training step. You refuse to tunnel through the optimizer. And instead, you treat the resulting weight change as just a fixed part of how the episode unfolds. The reward still credits or blames the flashcard writing, just through the normal channel.
And the reframe underneath that is kind of beautiful. Memory writing stops being a pre-processing step and becomes an action inside the agent's decision process, which is the thing that makes it trainable in the first place.
Right, that's the conceptual heart of the whole paper. Once writing memory is an action, not a chore you do off to the side, everything downstream follows. The RL machinery already knows how to make good actions more likely. You've just expanded what counts as an action to include writing supervision for your future self.
And does the reinforcement learning actually pay off more for this approach than for the older memory styles? Because that'd be the tell.
It does, and that's one of their cleaner findings. They trained all three memory styles, summary, retrieval, and theirs, with the same reinforcement learning, same data, same budgets. Everyone improves. But TMEM gets the largest lift. On one benchmark, it picks up about 5 F1 points from training, versus a bit under 3 for the others. Their read is intuitive. Reinforcement learning pays off more when the memory mechanism can actually adapt the weights during the episode. There's just more to teach when the channel is richer.
Let me make this concrete, because there's a case study in the paper that I think makes the whole abstract loop suddenly tangible. It's from the long conversation benchmark. The agent has, over a long multi-session history, been told about a bunch of separate things this person sold at various markets. And at the end, it's asked, "What's the total you earned selling products at markets?" And you can watch it compose the answer. $225 from jam, $150 from herb plants, $120 from organic herbs. Adds them up, $495. And here's the thing. Each of those individual sales was something it had distilled into a flashcard and baked into its weights at different points in the session. The context where it originally learned each one was long gone, cleared away. But the knowledge survived in the parameters, and at the end, it pulled the pieces together and reasoned over them.
And that's the distinction from pure recall that I think matters. It's not retrieving three stored sentences and reading them back. It's composing distilled facts it had internalized at different times into a new computation. That's much closer to the bike riding picture. The knowledge is shaping how it reasons, not sitting in a drawer waiting to be read.
There's one more result I genuinely did not expect, and it's about cost. You'd assume that all this online training, the gradient steps, the adapter updates, makes this approach the expensive one. The counterintuitive finding is the opposite. The baseline that uses the most GPU memory is the one with no memory mechanism at all.
Wait, the no memory baseline is the heaviest? How does that work?
Because no memory means you just keep everything in the context window, and that grows without bound through a long episode. And attention cost scales roughly with the square of context length, so it balloons. On their longest benchmark, the no-memory baseline hits something like 78 gigabytes of GPU memory. TMM sits comfortably in the middle, lighter than no-memory, a touch heavier than pure summarization, and faster than retrieval on the long tasks. So the parametric channel isn't just more accurate, it's genuinely cheaper than dragging your entire history around in the prompt.
Which is the practical argument that I think will land with anyone actually building long-running agents. The context window is the bottleneck. it's expensive, and it's lossy. And here's a way to preserve the influence of old information without paying the quadratic tax of keeping it loaded. That's a real engineering win, independent of all the conceptual elegance.
So that's the case for it. Tyler, you've been sitting on the skeptical read. Where does this not hold up?
So let me be fair but honest, because the paper is, to its credit, pretty candid about most of this. The first thing, that headline number, beating the best baseline by about 10 F1 points, is real. But it's the best case, not the typical case. On one benchmark with the smaller model, the difference over the best baseline is essentially a tie. 25.7 versus 25.7. And on one of the search splits, the authors themselves describe their one-point gain as directional rather than decisive. So the average improvement across everything is more modest than the headline suggests. I'd want a listener to hold both. The ceiling is impressive. The floor is a wash.
That's fair. And there's the context learning benchmark, which is a little thornier.
Right. On their context learning benchmark, they ran the evaluation on a filtered subset. They kept 289 instances out of nearly 1,900. And they're transparent about why. Most instances were just too hard for any 4 or 8 billion parameter model to do anything with, so there was no signal to compare on. They explicitly say they didn't pick instances where their method wins. I believe that. But the honest skeptic's note is that on the full benchmark, everyone is scrambling around the floor. TMEM gets 5%, the no-memory baseline gets 4.6. So the context learning claim really rests on a constructed subset where signal exists at all. The absolute capability there is weak across the board.
And what about that SVD theorem you were so taken with? Does it actually prove the method works better, or just that it starts better?
That's the right question. And the answer is, it proves it starts better. The theorem shows the initialization gives a better low-rank target before any training happens, under a spectral alignment assumption. That's a clean, real result. But the leap from better starting approximation to better final task performance after online training, that's empirical, not proven. And the assumption it rests on is argued to hold in practice rather than verified for each task. So the theory is suggestive scaffolding around an empirical result, not a guarantee of the end outcome. I don't think that's a flaw, exactly, but it's worth not overselling the word prove.
And the stop gradient, that's an approximation by design, isn't it?
It is, and they're upfront about it. By cutting the gradient at the optimizer, they're deliberately ignoring how the flashcard writing influences reward through the weight update. They credit the flashcard action only through the outcome reward. And in a long episode, that credit assignment is noisy. The model gets blamed or rewarded for its study guide based on the final exam score. But a lot of other things happened on that exam too. Whether a particular flashcard actually helped is genuinely hard to disentangle. It's a principled shortcut, but it is a shortcut.
And the scale question hangs over all of it.
Completely. Everything here is 4 billion and 8 billion parameter models, all from one model family. Whether this fast weight mechanism behaves the same on a much larger model or a different architecture is just untested. And the few-step adaptation regime, the very thing that makes the SVD initialization so crucial, might behave quite differently at other scales. So I'd file this as a genuinely promising small-scale exploration whose generality is still to be proven rather than a settled result.
Which I think is the right note to land on, honestly. Because the most interesting thing here isn't really the benchmark numbers anyway.
Say more about that.
The thing that'll stick with me is the loop itself. Training a model to generate its own future training data, and then using reinforcement learning to make it good at it. The memory application is the proof of concept, but that pattern is bigger than memory. The idea that an agent's experience should change not just what it knows, but how it thinks, that the weights themselves are a place to put experience, that's been the neglected channel. And someone finally built the version where that channel is switched on and trainable.
And the quotable version of the whole thesis is right there in the paper. Memory is most effective when it can both be read from context and written into fast model parameters at test time. Both channels, not one or the other. The field had been doing the first and treating the weights as sacred. This says, stop treating them as sacred.
Which brings us all the way back to the bike. The agent that learns from experience instead of just rereading its notes. There's a long road between an 8 billion parameter proof of concept and an assistant that genuinely grows with you over months. But this is one of the first papers that makes the road feel like it actually goes somewhere.
And it does it without hand waving. The mechanism is concrete, the ablations are honest, the limitations are flagged. That's the kind of small paper that ends up mattering more than its benchmark table suggests.
That's our look at scaling self-evolving agents via parametric memory. If you want to dig in yourself, the paper and a few related reads are in the show notes.
And if you want the full transcript with every term defined in line, plus the concept pages that link this over to the other episodes we've done on agent memory and test time training, that all lives on paperdive.ai.
Thanks for spending it with us. This has been AI Papers, a deep dive.